Edgar Feuchtwanger. In my 90th year, I was born in Germany, in Munich, but I've lived in this country now for about 75 years.
And for many people, you are the man who lived just around the corner from Hitler. An interesting claim to fame.
Yes, probably my only claim to fame. But, yes, actually, I was there first. Or at any rate, my grandmother lived in the house in which I came to live as a child before the First World War. And Hitler only moved there in about 1929, when he was on the up and up. Before that, he lived in a somewhat less salubrious area, and then he moved into this flat, which the socialists always said, Hitler says he's a friend of the workers, but he lives in a nine-room flat in Munich. So, anyway, that's how it came to be. And the first thing I think I heard about it was when my mother said, we haven't got much milk today. The milkman said he had to deliver extra bottles at Hitler's. And I think the first time I remember probably seeing him was when he was perhaps just Chancellor in 1933. And I, at that time, was 8 years old. And I was taken for a walk by my nanny. Of course, we all had nannies and that sort of thing. And we came in front of his house, his front door, the front door of the block. And just that moment, he came out and he looked at me. And there were a few casual people around who shouted Heil Hitler, and he didn't salute, he just lifted his hat a little bit and got into the car. And that's, I think, the first time I remember seeing him. And of course, I then saw him many times. One always knew he was there because his big Mercedes cars were parked by the curbside, and you couldn't then walk any longer just in front of his front door. And so I saw him getting into the cars. He had his black shirt, bodyguards by then. It was a motorcade. It was about three of these big Mercedes cars. And he then came out, sat by the chauffeur in front, and it roared off. I mean, I remember seeing that many, many times.
And it could have been quite dangerous, because you're from a Jewish family and your uncle was extremely anti-Nazi.
Yes, my uncle was a celebrity, a worldwide celebrity, I have to say. He wrote the novel Juices, which was made into film, the notorious propaganda film then by the Nazis, and so on and so forth. And then he wrote a novel called Success, which is a panoramic picture of Bavaria at the time of the Beer Hall Putsch in the 1920s. And it paints an extremely satirical picture of Hitler, which infuriated Hitler, as you can imagine. And he really became, in many ways, public enemy. Well, he was called that, public enemy number one, by the Nazis, because once they were in power, and he, of course, by that time had to be abroad, but he continued to be very active. He wrote a novel called The Oppermans, which we made a television thing, which is a picture of what went on in Germany in 1933, which he wrote to warn the public. And, of course, he had a large international public at that time. And so he was in many ways more active in opposing the Nazis than the former politicians could be, of course, who had all to go into exile and were limited in what they could do.
And there you were, living just a few yards away.
And I was living just a few yards. If he had known who I was, I wouldn't be here for sure. He would have had us drop down the oubliette, you know, we would have disappeared.
Your family decided to leave after your father was taken to Dachau.
Yes, well, he was taken to Dachau after Kristallnacht. We didn't know would we ever see him again, because, again, if they discovered he was the brother of Leon, he would be dead on the spot. Fortunately, the third wife wasn't quite as well organized as all that. They didn't discover that. But, of course, he had a very bad time there, you know, standing for hours in the freezing cold, and if you collapsed, they just finished you off and so on. But fortunately, he did get out. I mean, this whole action after Kristallnacht, after November 1938, was really intended to give the Jews a fright and make them leave. That was the policy at that point.
And it worked, you did?
And for us, it did work, yes. Fortunately.
And all the family got out safely?
Yes. It was not that easy, but we were lucky in many ways, because the one thing that finally did become available was called a capitalist visa to this country. If you deposited £1,000 with the British Treasury, then you could get a family visa. And, of course, fortunately, we had relations, including my uncle, who could stump up that sort of money, which was a lot of money in 1939. And so that is how we got out.
It must have been strange, living out the war here in England, looking across the Channel, seeing what was going on.
Well, I was 14 at the time, and I was just, I suppose, young enough. You suddenly switch completely. You switch languages, everything is different. And of course, I was in a very curious position. After being here 6 or 7 months, I was sent to Winchester, so I'm an old Wickhamist. So I've got a very checkered background in two countries.
And then the University of Southampton.
And eventually, in between the University of Cambridge. Yes.
So when did you first arrive at Southampton, and what were you doing there?
I think I came to Southampton in something like 1948-49, and I was in adult education. When I was at Cambridge, I had a tutor who was very keen on, you know, it was then called the Workers' Educational Association, WEA, so I was, as it were, programmed into that sort of field, and that's how I got tied up with the University of Southampton. And it was only a bit later that I got into the history department, or partly in history. Eventually, I think it was completely in history, and that's how my connection with the history department started.
And a very different history department to the one we know today.
I suppose the whole methods were totally different. We lectured, you know, until the cows came home. We, as I said, I had a course which was called Politics and Parties, and there were 42 lectures stretching even into the third term. The lectures only finished when the exams started. And, of course, linked to the lectures were tutorials, so we had little tutorials groups. But the lectures, basically, you talked for, I think it was 50 minutes, when the bell rang, you stopped in mid-sentence, woe betide if you went over, and the next time you took up exactly at that place, and that you did for twice a week, and it added up, I think, to 42 lectures, which I don't think anybody would do now.
And you studied, you taught British political history, yeah. not German, as people might think you would.
Yes, I taught British. Well, I mean, because, of course, I had the normal syllabus in Cambridge. That's what I knew most about. And, my course was called Politics and Parties, and it stretched from the repeal of the Corn Laws in 1846 to the first Labour government in 1924. That was the period I covered in very considerable detail.
As a historian, are you surprised that there's still so much interest these days in the period of the Third Reich, and of course Hitler in particular?
Not particularly, because, I mean, that is the big, almost atom bomb of the 20th century, isn't it? And Hitler is such a sort of outsized figure, rather like, I suppose, Napoleon was for the 19th century, and a frightening sort of figure. And, of course, that continues to attract interest. That doesn't surprise me.
Do you think the world has learned lessons? Could there be another Hitler?
Perhaps some parts of the world have learned lessons, but there seem to be people around who are not so dissimilar. Look at North Korea or something like that.